Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast from WNYC, made on Varick Street.
I'm John Schaefer. Tonight, here in New York, the Allman Brothers Band kicks off a 14-show run at the Beacon Theater. It's a residency that's become something of a tradition for this legendary group. But this year's set of shows is a big deal because of the recent announcement by two members, Derek Trucks and Warren Haynes, that they will be leaving the band. And that has some people wondering if this year might be the end of the Allman Brothers Band and their 45-year run. Now, that band has left its mark on most of the Southern rock groups who followed in their footsteps. For example, this week we had Drive-By Truckers in our studio, a country rock group with roots in Georgia and Alabama. You'll hear their live set on Monday night's show, but if you were tuned in to our daily live webcast at 2 p.m. on soundcheck.org, you would have heard us talking to the band's founding members, Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley, about their favorite Allman Brothers tracks. Here's Patterson.
I'd say go back and listen to some of Dwayne Allman's session work he did at Muscle Shoals right before the Allman Brothers launched. And in particular, go back to Hey Jude by Wilson Pickett, which is kind of the record that really got his career taken off. And because it's just amazing. It's one of my favorite guitar records of all time.
And Mike?
I'm the same way. That's some of my favorite stuff Dwayne did in particular. I love Live at Fillmore East as much as anybody. It's you know, there were a few years where I listened to it constantly. I think everybody goes through that. Probably the greatest live album ever made.
That's Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley from the band Drive-By Truckers with their essential tracks from the Allman Brothers Band. That one, Midnight Rider, featured Dwayne Allman on guitar and Greg Allman singing. And in a little while, we'll revisit our conversation with Greg Allman and hear him playing live in the Soundcheck studio. But all this talk of the Allmans has gotten us to thinking. It's time for us to unveil the Soundcheck Guide to the Allman Brothers. And joining us is Alan Paul, who wrote the new biography of the band. It's called One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band. Hi, Alan.
Hi, John.
What do you make of the announcement that Warren Haynes and Derek Trucks are leaving? Will the Allman Brothers Band, as we have come to know it, just kind of head on off into the sunset?
Every fiber of my being, everything I know from researching the ins and outs of this twisted 45-year history says that it would be a mistake to ever assume that anything is final or that it's over. There's been several points where people thought it was done. Right now, it's very hard to imagine them continuing without Derek and Warren.
Yeah.
But the three current founding members in the band, Greg Allman, Butch Trucks, and J-Mo, will ultimately make that decision, and they've very studiously not talked about it. And I've spoken with especially Butch and J-Mo about it at length, and they basically just say, we're not ready to talk about this. And so it's a big no comment, and that's in the middle of a lot of comment about a lot of things with me. So who knows?
All right. Well, it has been 45 years, as you alluded to. And so we asked you here today to kind of give us a guide to some of the basics, the essentials, and maybe some deeper cuts that, you know, even fans may not be aware of, and maybe, you know, periods or tracks to avoid as well. Let's start at the beginning. You mentioned Greg Allman and J-Mo and Butch Trucks. Then, of course, there's Dwayne Allman, mm-hmm. the other of the Allman Brothers in the name. So how did the band start?
Well, the band started because Duane Allman was this phenomenal guitar player who was making a mark at Muscle Shoals doing sessions. He really burst on the scene on his second session ever, which was Wilson Pickett's Hey Jude. And it was Duane's idea to record Hey Jude, which was number four on the charts. And producer Rick Hall and Wilson Pickett both thought he was crazy. I think it shows a lot right off about Duane's personality that he not only suggested it but continued to persist when they both sort of laughed at him.
And what was he, like 19 at the time?
I believe he was 21. Yeah, but okay. I mean, Wilson Pickett was a major superstar, renowned for not being the easiest guy in the world.
Right.
I mean, his Wicked Pickett had many origins. And Rick Hall is a very serious, hardcore guy, again, producing one number one track after another. But Duane persisted on Hey Jude, and when they said, well, how are we going to do it, he just started playing it. And Eric Clapton told me in the book that he became aware of Duane when he heard Wilson Pickett. He heard the guitar break at the end, and he pulled over and had to listen to it, went home and called Atlantic and said, who is the guitar player on Hey Jude? So Phil Walden, who had been Otis Redding's manager, Otis was deceased. Phil was looking for a new project and to get into rock and roll because he had gone out to Monterey Pop with Otis and seen what was happening out there and said, I need to get in on this. That was where Jimi Hendrix debuted and made a mark for himself. So Phil was looking for something. He got word of Duane, this great guitar player, and he was really thinking, I've got the next great guitar player. Jimi Hendrix has the Jimi Hendrix Experience. Eric Clapton has Cream. Let's get a power trio behind him and get him out there and let's go. And Duane reportedly said, I ain't on an ego trip. So he set off looking for something very different. And another one of the first things he did was find another great guitar player in Dickie Betts. Mm-hmm. The very first member of the band he had signed up actually was J-Mo, who was a drummer who had played with Otis Redding and Percy Sledge. Then he got bass player Barry Oakley.
How big a deal was that to have a black drummer in a band?
It was a big deal. I think if they had been based in New York or San Francisco, probably wouldn't have been that big of a deal, but they weren't. He was forming the band in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. They then moved to Jacksonville. And as a band, when they really became what they became, they moved to Macon, Georgia, which mm-hmm. is where Phil Walden was from and where he was starting his Capricorn Records. And a bunch of long-haired, crazy, freaky hippies with a black guy in the band was a big deal in Macon in 1969.
So you had the two guitars, two drummers, you know, early band with Butch Trucks and
right.
J-Mo. A distinctive sound. Their debut comes out in 1969, and you've picked a track from that called Dreams. Why?
I think it's remains one of my very favorite Allman Brothers songs. And to this day, 43 years after Duane Allman's death, I get chills when I hear it played. And I know I'm not alone. I know for a fact I'm not alone. It's emblematic also of Greg Allman's great singing, of Greg's profoundly fatalistic songwriting. Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about young. He wrote this song when he was about 20. It was one of the first Keeper songs he wrote. And it's spare. It also reflects their heavy, heavy influence of modal jazz.
Very Miles Davis-y.
Very Miles Davis. Duane and Dickie Betts both liked jazz before they got together, but J-Mo was a lunatic for Miles Davis and John Coltrane and really got them listening to that. And they spent hours and hours listening to Kind of Blue specifically. And if you listen to Dreams, the bass line for it comes right from Miles Davis's All Blue. So there's a profound influence that I think it reflects this sort of incredible conglomeration of sounds that the band hit on. And it includes two of Duane Allman's best guitar solos.
This is from the 1969 self-titled debut album by the Allman Brothers Band and the song called Dreams.
Hilltop, baby. Get back.
Alan Paul, author of the new biography One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band, is with us on Soundcheck and presenting our Soundcheck Guide to the Allman Brothers Band. 45 years later, still going strong, and beginning tonight their 14-show run at the Beacon Theater here in New York, which has become a kind of annual tradition. This might be the last of them, though, with the announcement that dueling guitarists Derek Trucks and Warren Haynes are leaving the band. You mentioned that Duane Allman was sort of he was the nexus around which this band coalesced, and he's also the first to pass away at the age of 24.
Correct.
So what was he like? What made his playing so distinctive? What made Eric Clapton pull over to the side of the road and then call the record company to find out who he was?
Well, because Clapton knew when he heard that was what he wanted to be. That's my judgment. You know, Duane as a guitar player was coming from such a pure place, and eventually he played with so many different people. They did a wonderful box set called Sky Dog that includes a lot of his session work. And I think it's really interesting to hear that outside the context of the Allman Brothers Band. Of course, he ended up playing on Derek and the Dominoes' Layla. So, you know, Eric Clapton's most famous guitar riff was actually written and played by Duane. Mm-hmm. What really struck me in writing the book, his musical legacy, I feel I understood quite well. I think it speaks for itself if you listen and pay attention and care to learn. But his personality, the power of him as a person, struck me. And when I talked to people, certainly all the members of the band, also the road crew and people like Eric Clapton, friends like John Hammond, they still talk about Duane as if he was in the room with them last week or yesterday. He was so vital. He remained so alive to them. And everybody would tell me variations of, you only meet someone like him once in your life. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just the musical power. It was this incredible force of personality.
And again, a life cut incredibly short. 24 years old, dies in a motorcycle accident. Shortly after, right? After the release of the Fillmore East record?
Correct. The Fillmore East had come out and had started to be a success. And he was going around saying, boys, ain't no more beans for us.
Duane was
saying that. He saw it coming. He knew it was happening, but he never really got to enjoy it.
For many people, Allman Brothers Band live at Fillmore East is kind of the essential record because it's them caught live. Are they a live band first and a studio band second?
Yes, although, you know, contrary to most bands who you would describe that way, I think they have done some great work in the studio. But certainly on stage, that the music really has always come to life. And I think Fillmore East captures, you know, a premier live band and a premier performance in their favorite place to play.
And this was 1971, and from the album you've picked, In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, which is, it's clearly another very jazz-based, jazz-inspired piece. But this is a very different form of improvisation from the Allman Brothers Band at Fillmore East. In Memory of Elizabeth Reed, Allman Brothers Band at Fillmore East, classic 1971 recording, part of our Soundcheck Guide to the Allman Brothers Band. Alan Paul is with me on Soundcheck, author of One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band, an oral history of the group. He's also senior writer at Guitar World. And I guess one of the last songs that Duane Allman would have performed with the band is your next sort of essential pick.
Right. That's Blue Sky. The band was just three songs into recording the follow-up at Fillmore East, which became Eat a Peach when Dwayne was killed. So he had only recorded on three songs, which were Stand Back, Little Martha, the delicate dobro instrumental with he and Dickie Betts, and Blue Sky, which Dickie Betts wrote and sings beautifully. And remarkably, it's Dickie's first recorded vocal with the band. Up to that point, Greg had been the sole vocalist. Mm-hmm. I think it's a beautiful vocal. I think it's a beautiful melody. I play it in my band, and I can tell you that everybody thinks they know it, but it's a million moving parts, and it falls apart in an instant. I think Dickie did something brilliant with a handful of notes, and I think the guitar break with Dickie and Dwayne is just beautiful. I've always felt that if everyone would listen to it, it could end all wars.
Well, let's listen to it and see what happens. Was and is a big hit for the Allman Brothers Band. Dickie Betts' first lead vocal.
Right, and we heard on the first two songs some of the jazz influence, yeah. And, which I think still exists there, but you also hear the country influence there, which mostly came from Dickie.
Blue Sky, the name of that 1972 song from the Allman Brothers Band, Eat a Peach. So it's during the making of the record, as you say, that Dwayne Allman dies in a motorcycle accident. And you would think that, you know, maybe that would be, it's no longer the Allman Brothers. You only have one brother. You have Greg. But they continue on.
They continued on. And I think, you know, really it's one of the great unsung stories in rock, what they actually did in the wake of his death. They finished the album pretty brilliantly. Greg recorded Melissa, which he had written
another
much earlier.
Very well-known
yeah.
song.
Which he had written and apparently was one of Dwayne's favorite songs, but they had never recorded. Greg wrote Ain't Wasting Time No More, which is a very direct reference to Dwayne's passing. And Dickie wrote another great instrumental, Les Brères in A Minor. And they filled out the album with more tracks from the Fillmore, including One Way Out, which my book takes a title from, mm-hmm. and of course many people know from the radio and such.
So they would go on to have, you know, some really successful songs, really big hits post-Dwayne.
Right. Their next album actually became their most successful, which was Brothers and Sisters. And they were only two songs into recording that when Barry Oakley, bass player, died in a very similar accident.
Only a few blocks away from where Dwayne had passed
right,
away.
That's right. And again, remarkable feat to overcome that. The weight of what happened in those deaths did catch up with them a couple of years down the road. But musically, what they did to recover, I think, is quite amazing. And on Brothers and Sisters, they had their biggest hit, Ramblin' Man, which is also an anomaly because and it's one that they've struggled with to some extent because their biggest hit doesn't really sound like anything else in their catalog.
Yeah.
It's an odd situation.
On the other hand, when we asked you for a track to avoid, you didn't go to that song or that
period.
Oh, no,
period. I love Ramblin' Man. Yeah. I just think it's an odd song for them, but it's a good song.
But the early 80s, by which point they had broken up and already reformed,
right.
Not a great period for the band?
Right. They reunited in 1979, and they cut an album called Enlightened Rogues, which was decent. Actually, it has some really nice stuff on it, but the Capricorn Records fell apart. They signed with Arista. Run by Clive Davis. Mm-hmm. Clive was also signed Grateful Dead at the same time. And really, they tried to take both of those bands and some others and shoehorn them into the prevailing sound of the day. They brought in some outside songwriters. They brought in outside producers. And although the band still was mostly putting on really quite good live shows, the two studio records they did with Arista are really pretty bad. Now, they do have a handful of songs that if cut in a different time probably would have been pretty good, but they have a lot of bad songs. And
well, but this one, Straight from the Heart, in 1981, this was a top 40 song
right,
for the
Allman
Brothers
Band. It was the first
band.
Single. That's right. But I think that when you listen to it now, it just sounds all wrong, and the band's embarrassed about it, and they nobody feels very good about it. And
well, but here it is anyway, from the Allman Brothers Band, from the 1981 record Brothers of the Road. A must to avoid, according to Alan Paul, author of One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band. He's here with our sound check guide to the Allman Brothers Band, beginning their 14-show run tonight at the Beacon Theater here in New York. All right, so let's get back to the good stuff. I mean, you've given us some of the essentials,
right.
Our period to avoid. Is there something from post 1980s that,
sure.
that we should
well,
know.
They broke up not long after that Straight from the Heart and that whole fiasco, and they reformed in 1989. Nobody really knew what to expect coming on the heels of, you know, what was not an altogether successful reunion. But they came out of the gate pretty strong with the album called Seven Turns. They had introduced Warren Haynes, who, you know, is now known and beloved by many, but he was a new young guitar player.
Has his own band.
Has his own band.
Government Mule.
Also the Warren Haynes Band, and he's played with the Dead and many other people. But at the time, he was a young guy who was coming up, had played in the Dickie Betts Band for a few years. And they had bass player Alan Woody. And those guys just kind of really kicked it back to being the Allman Brothers Band and sounding like the Allman Brothers Band. And they started off from the start, I think, with really strong music. I think what we picked here is Nobody Knows, which is from their second comeback album, Shades of Two Worlds.
Nobody Knows, from the 1991 album, Shades of Two Worlds. So this is the Allman Brothers Band version 3.0 or
yeah,
something like that.
Kind of hard to count because there's been a lot of ins and outs. But that was a band that really reestablished them as a real band, and that's kept them going to this time, although there's been a lot more changes since then.
Well, you know, there's obviously the two very early deaths. Then there's drug addiction and ego inflation and various kinds of dissolution and resolution. In 2000, Greg Allman and Dickie Betts can no longer stand the sight of each other, and Dickie leaves.
That's right. Right. And it was inconceivable at the time when they decided to proceed without Dickie Betts. And I cover it pretty extensively in the book. Exactly what happened remains a point of contention. Was Dickie fired? Did Dickie quit when they told him that they were going to play some shows without him while he got help in rehab? I think that the book provides some context to why things came to that head. But when it did come to that head, exactly what happened is, you know, I present both sides and people can sort it out. But it was inconceivable to many, frankly, including me, that the band could continue without Dickie Betts.
Because post-Dwayne, after Dwayne died, he sort of took the reins, didn't he?
Yes, and more so throughout this post-89 comeback. But the problem is that Dickie had no problem taking the musical reins. He's a clearly a brilliant guitarist and band leader, but he wasn't a leader of men the same way that Dwayne was. You know, there was a certain amount of intimidation that went on, and finally there was just a pushback. By 2000, Greg had overcome a lot of his own problems,
right.
And basically To sum it up, was sort of saying, I'm not going to take this anymore. Dickey had gone through several phases in 1993. He was arrested and left the band for about 20 shows. In 96, they had a big blow up and he missed a bunch of shows. In 2000, after the Beacon run and a spring tour, they felt that was happening again and basically said, we're going to play these shows, but we're not going to play them with you.
So in the post-Dickey Betts era, give us one final track that we should hear.
Sure. They've only recorded one album, and that was Warren Haynes actually had left the band in 97. He came back in 2001.
It's just dizzying trying to keep track of who's in and who's out.
That's right. It was essential for the band. I think when Warren came back, he had so much credibility. He wasn't just a great guitar player. He was a great guitar player with this extensive history with the band and, frankly, with Dickey. So he understood the music really from the inside. So they recorded one album, which was Hit in the Note, and I think the song I picked was The High Cost of Low Living.
And that's what we'll conclude with from the 2003 album by the Allman Brothers Band, Hitting the Note. Alan Paul is author of One Way Out, The Inside History of the Allman Brothers Band. It's a 45-year history that is hitting another milestone, maybe a stop sign, maybe something more permanent than that, who knows, as both Derek Trucks and Warren Haynes have announced that they are leaving the band. So it's a long and convoluted story. Alan, you tell it in your book. Thank you for telling
Thank
a bit
you.
Of it here on
Thank
Soundcheck
you for having
today.
Me.
Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.